As of 2015, contraceptive access is under heavy attack by U.S. state governments, Congress, and even the Supreme Court. From the Wing's archives, here's Melinda Tuhus with some history of the struggle for contraception in America.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
On June 7, 1965, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Connecticut ban on the use of birth control. In the Griswold v. Connecticut case, the court based its decision on the right to privacy. That set the stage for the decision in Roe v. Wade 8 years later that legalized abortion throughout the United States. But since birth control was legalized in 1965 and abortion in 1973, people with different values have been engaged in a passionate and sometimes even violent struggle. Those on one side believe that widely available birth control is good public policy, resulting in fewer abortions. Those on the other side believe that contraception and abortion are on the same side of the moral ledger and both must be opposed. I'm Melinda Tuhus, reporting for Wings, on the history and legacy of the Supreme Court ruling in Griswold v. Connecticut.
Planning your family seemed to me so benign and sensible, and the whole idiot law, which said you would have had to have a policeman in every bedroom, was so bizarre you couldn't possibly enforce the law. It was a stupid law. They had to get rid of it.
The Connecticut ban on birth control was written into law in 1879 under the state's Comstock Act, named for national moral crusader and Connecticut native Anthony Comstock. Similar laws existed in many states, but by the mid-20th century, they were enforced in just two: Massachusetts, which banned the sale of contraceptives, and Connecticut, which banned their use. But enforcement was selective, says Joan Forsberg. She was a student at Yale Divinity School in the 1960s, newly married and determined to finish her degree.
In Connecticut, I came to discover all my mother's good advice about getting a diaphragm wasn't going to work if you didn't have the money to go to a private doctor. The clinic wouldn't help you, couldn't help you, because of the law.
The Planned Parenthood League of Connecticut and its predecessor organization, the Connecticut Birth Control League, had been trying to get the law repealed for decades. Every time a repeal bill was introduced, Roman Catholic lawmakers voted as a block against it. In addition, the Connecticut Supreme Court on five occasions found that the state had a right to pass laws affecting the health, welfare, or morals of individuals. In the 1930s, the League opened birth control clinics in several Connecticut cities, but had to close them in 1940. 2 decades later, the state was still without any birth control clinics, so Joan Forsberg found a place outside Connecticut to get contraceptives.
Somebody said, go to Porchester in New York, which is right over the border, so it was an hour away. A bunch of us drove down the first time. I think there were three couples. We were all going to be married in June or July. We all went down, saw the doctors, and were taken care of down there. So then I just kept continuing to go back to Porchester. The thing was, why I felt strongly about being in the case, that the law was so manifestly unfair against poor women. And I, at this point, I was married and working in the inner city. And for women who had money to go to private OBSGYNs, they could get birth control no matter what the law said. Doctors would prescribe. They knew their patients weren't going to turn them in. Patients knew the doctors weren't going to turn them in. If you were poor or a student who didn't have money, whatever, and you went to the hospital clinic or a public clinic, they couldn't help you because of the law.
Eventually, Forsberg started taking other women with her.
They were all married women from my area that I took down. It never occurred to me to think about unmarried women, although God knows there were lots of them in our area, but it was the married women who would say to me, oh, how come you don't have any kids yet? They were so cute, they'd say. I'd say, because I'm going to finish school and I'm planning when I'm going to have my children. Oh, you'll stub your toe. And they had all these very strange ideas of how birth control worked. And then we'd fill up the van, you know, we'd have these wonderful conversations all the way down and back among ourselves, and someone would take their kids and stuff, and some really good sex education went on in those conversations in the van.
In the mid-1950s, Estelle Griswold became executive director of Planned Parenthood of Connecticut. Under her leadership and that of obstetrician Lee Buxton of the Yale School of Medicine, Planned Parenthood ramped up its opposition to the Comstock Law. A case brought by Planned Parenthood against the law made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the court dismissed it in 1961, with Judge Felix Frankfurter writing that the statute was not enforced since birth control was available in the state. Later that same year, having been thwarted for so long in the legislature and courts, the leaders of Planned Parenthood decided to take direct action. The organization opened a clinic in New Haven in 1961. Dr. Virginia Sturmer was one of the physicians who worked there.
When the first decision, the Frankfurter decision, came down, a decision was made to open up the clinic, hoping that we would be able to stay open, that we wouldn't be charged. But if we were charged, then we would have a case to take to the Supreme Court once again.
Dr. Sturmer was in charge the day police visited to determine if the law was being broken.
When I came to the clinic, the charge nurse said to me, "The cops are here, what shall we do?" And I said, "We'll see the patients," which is what we did.
The clinic was closed a few days later. Griswold and the medical director, Dr. Lee Buxton, were charged as accessories under the Comstock Act. Joan Forsberg expressed her gratitude to Griswold.
I said to Estelle, "It's really wonderful what you're doing for all of us, and if there's anything I can do to help you, let me know." 2 days later, called me up, said, "There's something you can do." And I said, "What? Tell me." She said, "You can turn state's evidence and get in the court case." I said, "Turn state's evidence against Planned Parenthood?" She said, "We're trying to get this case in court. We need some people who were there who will say, I advised you to use birth control. Dr. Buxton prescribed." And I said, "Yeah, and then they'll say, you took the pills, right? And then what?" She said, "They're not after you."
That was the beginning of the legal case known as Griswold v. Connecticut. Ruth Emerson is the widow of Tom Emerson, a Yale Law School professor who argued the Griswold case at the Supreme Court. A lawyer herself, she helped with research on the case.
A lot of people just thought that it was kind of a joke Obviously, Connecticut couldn't stop people from using contraceptives. But, you know, they just didn't know. Tom got hundreds of letters from women in Connecticut after the Griswold case, thanking him for being so, you know, it was such an important thing in their lives.
Susan Yolen, currently vice president at Planned Parenthood of Connecticut, vividly recalls hearing about the case.
It was 1961 when the arrest took place, and I know because I was a kid in Pennsylvania who knew that my mom was using birth control and was a church-going woman, mother of four, and frankly, having to share my bedroom with two other sisters, I was kind of, when I heard about it, I was happy. My mom's on the right track, you know? And what could be wrong with it? You know, I mean, that's my mom. She's not an unlawful person. And then when I heard about this case in Connecticut, I just had the weird, I mean, I thought, what kind of a place is Connecticut where my mother would be breaking the law? It was outrageous.
Arguments in favor of repealing the law ranged from the right of doctors to fully inform their patients of all medical options to the right of married couples to privacy in marital relations. Arguments against repeal ranged from the immorality of artificial birth control to the need to increase the population. No arguments were ever made by either side favoring the right of unmarried people to contraceptives. Attorney Catherine Rohrabeck helped prepare the legal briefs representing Planned Parenthood for both Supreme Court cases. She explains the situation before the Griswold victory.
The New York clinics only served supposedly married people, and frequently people accumulated or acquired a spouse on the way to New York, I think, in order to be able to get help there.
Privately, many involved in the case spoke of the need for all women to have access to birth control. But Rohrabeck says the lawyers representing Planned Parenthood believed they maximized their chances of winning the case by focusing on the rights of married couples.
Certainly the younger feminists who came along after that, because feminism really got going in the late 60s, they just never understood what the world had been like beforehand.
In the early 1960s, important religious voices weighed in on the matter. In 1961, the National Council of Churches, representing mainline Protestant denominations, condemned the anti-contraception statutes as violations of the religious and civil liberties of all citizens. In the spring of 1963, while the Griswold case was moving through the lower courts toward the Supreme Court, Boston Archbishop Richard Cardinal Cushing said the Catholic Church would no longer actively oppose repeal of anti-contraception laws in Connecticut and Massachusetts. This was a major shift from decades of previous activism. The right to privacy is not mentioned explicitly in the U.S. Constitution, but privacy arguments were based on interpretation of several amendments to the Constitution. However, privacy arguments took up only 15 of 100 pages in the brief that Planned Parenthood submitted to the Supreme Court. And Attorney Rohrabeck says she had made other arguments in previous cases.
I had argued in part of my brief that the right to use contraceptives was part of a right to life. That life wasn't mere physical existence, but it was a right to, you know, it's part of life, liberty, etc., and it's a right to live to the fullest.
But it was the privacy argument that won the case, with Justice William O. Douglas writing the majority opinion. Rohrabeck says she feels ambivalent that privacy was the basis for winning the case and became the foundation for all reproductive choice litigation.
Because the basic focus of privacy is that you have no right to talk to me about it. It isn't that I have a right to control my life. As a woman, I have a right to make these decisions, but it was that the government has no right to interfere in that decision. I would have preferred a more positive statement of it, and I think that it would have made a positive statement in the future if we had just been emphasizing the right of a woman to life as well as the rights of others. It's the right of the woman to control her life that is what we should have been talking about.
Some disagree with the Supreme Court decision, saying it introduced the concept of relativism into the Constitution, that as Americans moved away from objective values, in this case the immorality of birth control, the Constitution moved too. But others say a decision to legalize the sale and use of birth control in every state was way overdue. Susan Yolen is vice president of Planned Parenthood in Connecticut.
So kicking and screaming, we got pulled into the 20th century, really, in terms of birth control. It's sort of kind of, it's a badge of honor, but it's also sort of a shameful thing that we had to come to that.
It was true that Connecticut had been the last state to legalize the use of contraceptives, but now the Griswold decision marked a social and cultural watershed for the whole country, says Attorney Rohrabeck. After the Griswold victory, she served as counsel for Planned Parenthood.
The importance of that decision was to free women to be able to control their reproductive system and to be able to control their lives that way so that they could make plans. It was a sort of an essential basic step, which I think liberated a lot of women because it became such an issue that it went beyond just the right of a married couple to have contraceptives, but it began the development of the law so that women should have this right to control their bodies.
Others saw that development as a slippery slope. The Catholic Church has long opposed the use of what it calls artificial means of birth control, even for married couples. Sister Suzanne Gross works at the Franciscan Life Center in Meriden, Connecticut, and runs a seminar on marriage and sexuality. She sums up church teaching on the issue.
Conjugal love is intended to be total. It's intended to be human. It's intended to be exclusive, faithful, and fertile. And the fertile part is where we now run into the question related to contraception.
Church teaching does support abstinence and natural family planning in order to space the birth of children. Professor Margaret Farley, who teaches Christian ethics from a Catholic perspective at the Yale Divinity School, says the church's official position almost changed under Pope John XXIII at the same time the Griswold case was moving through U.S. courts.
So there was a time in the early 1960s when this issue arose in a significant way in the Roman Catholic community, so much so that a commission was appointed by the Vatican to consider the issue of whether the teaching of the church on birth control should be changed. This commission met over months. It had some theologians on it, it had lay people on it, it had clergy on it, and so on. And, of course, Pope John XXIII died before the results of this commission could be articulated. So Pope Paul VI was the pope when the task of the commission was finished. Now, this commission, a large majority of the members had consensus that the church's teaching should change on the prohibition against the use of methods of birth control. a small minority not only of the commission members as a whole, but a minority of the theologians on the commission were opposed to that. They thought that it should be sustained, the teaching should remain as it was. And as some now think, some think it's a good thing, some think it's a tragic thing, Pope Paul VI accepted the view of the minority, and so there was no change in the official teaching.
Farley adds that a large majority of practicing Catholics in America have said they do not abide by the Church's ban on birth control.
I would say that for many, many Christians, including Roman Catholics and evangelicals, the issue of birth control is almost a non-issue today.
It would seem that at least some people who oppose abortion would support contraception for the very reason that it reduces unwanted pregnancies, more than half of which in the U.S. end in abortion. But there may be fewer of those people than one might think. Connecticut Planned Parenthood's Susan Yolen says common ground is hard to find.
People know us because we stand up for abortion and safe legal abortion. They sometimes mistake us for a group that is only interested in abortion. But, I mean, we are the biggest provider of family planning in Connecticut. We do more to prevent abortion every day than people who oppose abortion. And so we think that actually our work, family planning and sex education and information is the middle ground. And I guess we're happy that the Democratic Party or Mrs. Clinton or whoever else wants to join us on that turf, we're happy to welcome them here. But it's not like we haven't been occupying that piece of real estate for a really long time. The trouble is finding people who are against abortion who are willing to join us there, because they're not. When you scratch them, they are against healthy sexuality. They're against sexual health information going to young people. They're against birth control very often for their own religious reasons. And, you know, I respect them, but they are, in fact, foisting those beliefs on others who don't share them.
Sister Suzanne Gross believes that the use of contraceptives contradicts God's idea of the sanctity of the body and the sanctity of marriage. But she adds,
our position is not one of imposing, I think our position is one of really trying to help people understand how we are made.
From the Wings Archives, this is The Struggle for Contraception in America, first released in 2005. Issues that were current then are coming to the fore again.
The Bush administration wants to reduce the Medicaid budget, which funds contraception and prenatal care for poor women. And many states are considering bills that would allow pharmacists to refuse to fill women's birth control and emergency contraceptive prescriptions. Groups promoting women's access to contraceptives as a way to prevent both pregnancy and disease point out the government is removing critical reproductive health care information from its websites or putting up misinformation, such as claims that condoms are ineffective most of the time. Sex education is one of the most controversial issues of all. The Catholic Church and conservative Protestant evangelical churches, as well as the Bush administration, support abstinence until marriage. Sister Suzanne Gross says young people have often been hurt by being pushed into sex at an early age.
There is a huge groundswell for abstinence and abstinence-only education, and it's based upon not a religious issue at all, but based upon the self-esteem that every person is entitled to.
Joan Forsberg, who participated in the Griswold case on the side of Planned Parenthood and who went on to become dean of students at Yale Divinity School, is not in favor of pushing teens and preteens into sex, but she disagrees with abstinence-only education.
You see, I think that is so backward-looking, and if you don't do something about good, sensible sex education and giving people prevention for pregnancy, then you end up with people needing abortion. And that's been true for eternity.
A peer-reviewed study of the top 10 abstinence-only programs, praised as effective by conservative groups, concluded that they are effective in postponing vaginal intercourse for up to 18 months. But the study also revealed that 88% of 20,000 teens who had taken an abstinence-until-marriage pledge broke their pledge, and that many of the remaining 12% engaged in oral and anal sex while remaining technical virgins. The study concluded that none of the abstinence-only programs are as effective in preventing teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections as a combination approach, one that encourages abstinence as the first and best choice for teens, but also urges them to use condoms and contraceptives if they do have sex. Planned Parenthood hires and trains teens to run a peer program called STARS, Students Teaching About Responsible Sexuality. In New Haven, Connecticut, high school senior Samantha Pelkey has been a STARS peer educator for 3 years. She was motivated by her older sister giving birth to twins at the age of 14.
Basically, our job is to educate our peers on what it is to have safer sex and educate them about the risks as well as the pleasures of partaking in safer sex.
What about abstinence?
Well, in regards to abstinence, if you noticed, I said safer sex because there is no safe sex. Basically, the only way it's going to be 100% safe is if you abstain from having sex. We do pretty much lay that out there, but if they're going to have it, they might as well be safe about it. So we explain all different types of barrier methods, like regular male condoms, the usage of female condoms, the usage of dental dams, what you could do that could be pleasurable for the relationship without having intercourse.
Pelkey says the peer educators take a different approach with younger students than with high schoolers. With middle school students, she says,
we pretty much focus on the fact or fiction type stuff, like, for example, one of the myths that we heard from an inner city middle schooler was that cinnamon Altoids could be used as a spermicide. Okay. So we try to knock down those myths and give them the factual information. Whereas a conference that we just did in March was called True Colors. Those kids are definitely more sophisticated and more knowledgeable in sexuality and from all different orientations as well. So those types of conferences, we try to work on communication, how you can communicate having safer sex with a certain partner and how you can just feel more comfortable about certain issues and like dealing with some myths as well. Not exactly myths like the Altoid thing, but when you should start using protection and how you should ask and stuff like that. When females come up to me, like younger girls of my school, they'll be like, oh, well, what can we do instead? And I'll give them suggestions as to like, well, you can do X, Y, or Z, but you don't have to have sex if you're not ready to. Unfortunately, they kind of all succumb to it, and they eventually do it.
You said unfortunately, meaning even if they didn't really choose that themselves, they felt pressured into it?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think it's so much, hey, my boyfriend really wants me to do it, so I'm going to do it. I think a lot of it has to do with we're going into college soon, and, you know, not that it's the cool thing to do, but I would feel kind of weird if I was still a virgin. I think a lot of it has to do that since we're moving on up, we kind of have to do whatever we can to feel like adults.
Pelkey says most middle and high school students don't get the same information as the teens trained by Planned Parenthood.
Throughout middle school and elementary school, we had no sex ed. We had a health class, but it focused on like eating disorders, and that was basically it. When it came time for them to start talking to us about sex, basically the argument was nobody wanted to teach a room full of boys, so nobody got the sex education part of it. We ended up doing a mock trial about cigarettes. And then when I was a freshman in New Haven, it kind of came full-fledged, like we did the baby think it over things.
Pelkey's fellow peer counselor, Janisha DeBose, agrees.
It was mandatory for us to take health in seventh grade, but like she said, it wasn't like a focus on sex. It was drugs, alcohol. That was the two biggest things in middle school, drug, alcohol, and eating disorders, how people get stressed and stuff like that. It wasn't like when the sex part came, that just flew by. That's like, what, a day or something?
You are listening to a Wings program about contraception in the U.S., first released in 2005 during the Bush era. In 2010, Congress sharply reduced federal funding for abstinence-based sex education in schools and added money for evidence-based sex education. In 2015, the Republican-dominated Congress increased funding for abstinence-based programs.
There is no national data on how many schools are teaching which kind of sex education programs because sex ed decisions are made at the local level, not even necessarily the school board level, but within individual schools. But Adrian Verrilli of SECUS, the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the U.S., says her organization did a state-by-state analysis of where federal abstinence until marriage money is going.
We've done an analysis of what types of groups are receiving the funding, and we have found that over 26% of the money is going to anti-abortion groups and crisis pregnancy centers. The rest of the money is going to other types of faith-based groups, community-based organizations, some school districts directly. There's definitely the evangelical base of the Bush administration getting a tremendous amount of the money.
The New Haven, Connecticut school system put in place a comprehensive K-12 social development curriculum that covered many interpersonal, non-academic subjects. Sex education was just one part of it. Carolyn Ross Lee, the outreach coordinator for the program, explains how it works.
Sexual decision-making comes at kind of 7th and 8th grade relationships, you and your relationships, and values and choices, to make them look at the decisions that they're making, what kind of situations they're getting in. It's really problem solving and, you know, prevention. Don't make these choices, you know, without expecting certain consequences. So curriculum across the board for problem solving skills that students need, people need. I mean, whenever we're in a class doing sex education, of course, students want to talk about sex. Well, what happens with this? Or, you know, we try to keep their questions. We ask them to write their questions down. And then, you know, they hand them in to us, and then we can answer them in the appropriate way. You know, we're not graphic in any way. And as graphic as their questions tend to be, we try to just stick to the facts and, you know, eliminate the myths. We have a lot of kids out there who get the information from each other, and the information is all inaccurate. Then they have these, you know, accidents, and they're like, well, you don't want 13-year-olds pregnant.
The district made national headlines several years ago when it decided that condoms would be available in the clinics in some high schools and middle schools, which serve children as young as 10. It was done mainly to fight transmission of HIV and AIDS, but also address the teen pregnancy rate, which dropped from a high of 19 per 1,000 teen women in 1996 to 13 per 1,000 teens in 2003. Condoms are still available in school-based clinics, but students have always needed parental permission to access the services there. Meanwhile, the national pregnancy rate stood at 99 per 1,000 teen women in 1973, rose 20% by 1990, and by 2000 dropped to 85.6. This reduction took place before abstinence-only programs came into vogue. Where does abstinence fit in the New Haven curriculum?
It's right up there with everything else. Abstinence is the only sure way to be free of disease, to be free of pregnancy. Although they're capable of having sex, they're not capable of handling a sexual relationship. So abstinence is the best way to avoid any of those complications. However, their bodies, their hormones, they are raging. And so, you know, we have to deal with the reality that these kids see sex everywhere. They get exposed. There's less money out there if you're not doing abstinence only. So social development is largely funded through special funds. So it limits our ability to fund ourselves, you know. So there's less money out there if you are a program that offers a wide scope of services. If you're dealing with directly abstinence only, and that's the only message that you're giving, then there's plenty of money.
From New Haven, Connecticut, I'm Melinda Tuhus, reporting for Wings.
To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks ever so much to our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.